Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Starting podcast now. That's how I started every time, Rob. Hello, everyone. You have tuned in to The Three Questions, which is my podcast. I'm Andy Richter. It's no one else's. It's mine, mine, mine. However, I share it each week with a guest of my choosing. I don't let people get shoved onto me, you know, forced onto me. They're all people I enjoy, whose company I like to keep. And one of my favorite people is on today. It's Rob Delaney. It's America's sweetheart, Rob Delaney. America's sweetheart who ran away and went to a different country.
I did.
I'm speaking to you from, you're in London, correct?
I sure am, yeah.
You seem classier. You seem so classy, you know?
Oh, everything God, in no. London
super classy.
Yeah, there's classy aspects. I mean, I'm not classy. I mean, I know the video element is not, part of your podcast, but I know you can see me. And you've already, you know, while we were doing the preliminary stuff, you commented on my back sweat, which is true.
Yes. And that's me all over. If I see back sweat, I got to point it out.
He shouts it out.
That's why it's why my showbiz career is shot in right to the middle, because of my candor, my
your
tackiness.
Astute, yeah, your astute perspiration observation.
That's right. So it's dinner time there, 5 o'clock, right?
Dinner time approaches. We don't eat too much after 5 o'clock, I guess, because I have little children, you know.
Yeah.
Not, I have one little child and then two medium-sized children who are 7 and 9.
How old is the little one?
He just turned 2.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a house full of all kinds of different noise.
Yeah, a lot of boys noise.
Yeah.
And it's fun. I mean, we did it on purpose. It's not, it hasn't taken us by surprise. We knew what would happen.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, and they are, I find children to be beneficial to your life. I have two.
They have been to mine. I'm one of those people, I don't proselytize. Like, if people are like, should I have kids? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, if you do want to, then yes. If not, don't. I mean,
right.
God knows there are plenty of people without kids who are leading fulfilling lives. I like mine. Glad I had them. You know, if you want to have some, be my guest. If you don't, I may the road rise to meet you.
So how long have you lived in the UK now?
Almost 6 years, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, just about. Yeah, let's say 6 years.
Yeah. Do you think this is a permanent move?
I don't know. You know, we moved here for the TV show Catastrophe, and we figured it would be
the fucking fantastic TV show Catastrophe.
Well, thank you very much.
Really funny and complex and wonderful. Yeah,
thank you. And you know, like any TV show, we thought it would get canceled pretty quick, and I'd get sent back to the U.S. And like, my wife took a leave of absence from her job teaching in L.A., thinking we'd come back. And then, you know, the show kept going. We got a second season. And then, as you know, my son Henry was born here. And then a little after he turned 1, he was diagnosed with brain cancer. And we were going to move back. We were going to do the third season and then move back. But then he got sick and was sick for almost 2 years before he died. And yeah. then we couldn't do anything, you know, like his death was not up to us, but uprooting our kids for a further traumatic experience, since they don't even remember LA, was not possible, you know, or advisable. And my wife yeah. was pregnant again with a fourth child. So life just happened in a, you know, pretty dramatic and brutal fashion. And so now that we've been here, you know, like our 9 and 7 year old, they came here when they were 3 and 1, and they like it. We like it. We miss LA. I mean, we didn't flee LA. God knows there's plenty of wonderful stuff about it, but it's also great here. And I was surprised to find out how viable a career in film and TV and comedy is here. So I didn't, I wasn't struggling to find work. Any, you know, it was the same sort of appetite for whatever it is I provide over here as there was in LA. So here we are, you know? And so I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen.
So the staying there wasn't so much predicated on Henry's care, but on just not uprooting the other kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Once Henry died, we knew that moving anytime soon after that would be very stupid.
Yeah.
But at the same time, by not doing that, more time, of course, passed. And so, and here we are 6 years later, which is remains shocking to my wife and I.
Yeah. You're from New England originally, right?
Yeah. I grew up in Marblehead, Massachusetts. I'd love to be there right now, which I often would be, in August. But you know, because of travel restrictions, because of coronavirus, we are not there.
Mm-hmm. And it, are your folks, a lot of people still there, a lot of family still there?
Yeah. 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 Everybody's there. My mom, my dad, my sister. And so, yeah, I mean, love to go back. I mean, my God, I'm like feeling lightheaded thinking about what it would be like to be back there right now, now that I can't
yeah,
be there.
Yeah. Yeah. What kind of town is it? I don't know New England very well.
Marblehead is, it's like 30 minutes north of Boston, and it's on the water, and it's a population of around 20,000. So it's a small town, comprised of, really a peninsula and then like a little causeway to another kind of attached island. And, so it's small, beautiful. There's like a ridiculous, I think if the town is like 4 square miles, there is somehow 115 miles of coast. In the town itself. And, so yeah, yeah. Postcard picture town, and, very beautiful. Yeah. My first jobs as a kid, well, my first job was delivering the Boston Globe. But then after that, was teaching sailing on little 12-foot sailboats, as a teenager. So pretty idyllic, wonderful, wonderful place.
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like it.
Mm.
And, so you have one other sibling, correct?
Yeah. I have a sister who's 5 years younger.
Yeah. And, what did your folks do?
When I was younger, they both co-owned and operated, an independent insurance agency. So, yeah, if you needed fire insurance or car insurance, you would go to them and, they would, give it to you. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, yeah, a little office, that they ran, until my parents got divorced when I was 14. And then my mom, did all that. And then my dad, a few years later, wound up at the North Bennett Street School, being the director of admissions there. And that's a funny school in Boston where, you can like learn how to build a violin or a shed with no nails, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And really cool stuff. But we lived with my mom after my parents got divorced, and, Yeah, and she continued slinging insurance, which, you know, helped put us through college. And yeah, just recently retired.
Why did she keep the business and your dad moved on to other things?
Well, I guess since they were, it was because of the divorce. And
yeah.
And so, you know, they didn't want to work together after they got divorced.
Well, no, I mean, I know that, but why didn't, you know, why didn't your dad, didn't he not want to open a competing insurance agency or something?
To do insurance war with her? I am now remembering. Yeah, yeah. Because this
Sounds like a...
I'm probably like an 80s
Bette Midler movie.
I am now remembering that, in fact, he did do insurance for a few years after that somewhere else in Massachusetts and then branched out into other stuff. So they did do that, but they didn't compete as far as I know.
Yeah. And this school, is it for children? Is it just sort of...
it's for... I think you have to be 18 to go there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And it's just purely for project-based learning?
Yeah.
It's not a college. It's just...
It is. I mean, you do get a degree. And you did totally graduate with a... skill, you know, that is, you know, my dad went there before he started working there. So he did, in fact, build stuff without nails. And so he went there for carpentry and restoration of old things that already don't have nails. You know, a young upstart
such prejudice against nails.
Yeah, he hates that. Well, look, it's another generation, you know, and I've tried to, you know, he knows that I will occasionally use nails. We don't really talk about it, but you know,
maybe, or he might, you know, he might have some Christ complex, which would lead one to be anti-nail.
That's the likeliest factor, I think.
Now, is your family from New England going back and back and back? Because I always, always fascinated by people that live in such beautiful places. Like, how do you end up, you know, how does the biological lottery end you up in like a beautiful, picturesque town where you can teach sailing?
Yeah, right. So, my parents picked Marblehead just because it was beautiful, I think. My mom grew up a couple towns over in Beverly, Massachusetts, and my dad grew up in Jamaica Plain, which is a neighborhood in Boston. And, you know, they moved around a little bit, you know, but then when I was around three, they just picked Marblehead. And God, am I glad they did. And, but then, like even all my grandparents, for example, were born in the United States. I think once you get to great grandparents, you've got people who were from Ireland, and then go further back than that, you might have a little England and Germany. But at least all my grandparents were born here, which is to say my parents could have run for president if they wanted to. If they chose not to.
Now talk about that's a blown opportunity.
I know, right? Nice. Shouldn't,
You could have been a real spoiled brat.
Yeah. Not a day goes by that I don't chastise them for that.
Was it a happy house? I mean, leading up to their divorce, was it a fairly happy home? Or
yeah, it really was. I feel very fortunate because they did all the stuff that you know that you should do with young kids, and what you should do with young kids, I'm learning, is you should be in the same room with them often. They should be on your lap often. You should be reading to them, tousling their hair, having fights in front of them with your spouse, and then apologizing and making up and having them see that, you know. But just it's proximity, kindness. If there's a mistake, acknowledge it and fix it, you know. So they were both great parents, truly, in the formative years.
What kind of kid were you? Were you a funny kid then? Or
I
were
wanted
you
to be. I was. I loved to read. I loved to take standardized tests. I know that's indicative of something wrong with me, but I truly did. Anything fill out a bubble for a test, I loved it. I liked to draw little cartoons and make up little stories and do art and stuff like that. And so that's as a young kid. Wasn't very athletic, last picked for the sport, and notice I called it the sport, just any sport.
Sure.
I repeated a year of Little League baseball. I was the only kid I know who did that.
I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah, they had in my town, there were three levels. There was farm, minors, and majors. And I progressed from farm to minors, but then when everybody else went from minors to majors, they were like, Rob, why don't you stick around? And not very athletic.
Too much pressure in the majors. Stick around. It's so laid back here. Now, what you are a large person. But were you sort of like, because I know from my small town upbringing, any large person was harangued into doing some sort of sporting event,
So at age 12, I played basketball for a year in Catholic school that I went to for just 1 year. And I was valuable among 12-year-olds because I was so tall that I got every rebound. And then also I could shoot. It didn't matter how many times I missed. I would always get the rebound and then finally get it in. So height helps at that age. But then as you get older, like at the high school, even if you're tall, if you still suck, then you're of no use. There was a little promise there, but then people were like, oh, wait a minute. He's not good. He's just big. So that was that. And then I found theater when I was, 13, and that was it. After that, that was all I wanted to do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And this was at school, doing plays at school?
Yeah.
And so does that mean, I'm going to be an actor, mom and dad? Is there a pronouncement of that? Or
I really think that I did. By the time I was, 16, 17, I was like, yeah, that's definitely what I want to do. They were cool with it, because I worked hard in the plays, and that was my favorite thing to do, plays and musicals. And they were pretty supportive of that. I don't know.
And then what?
I don't know. Then that's what I went to college for. What I was literally doing? I was sitting there obediently waiting for you to give me permission to move from high school to college within this conversation. I just want you to know.
if you're a stand up, you can just, do your act and I'll sit here.
Okay. Would it be possible for you to turn your microphone off except when you laugh? No. I did. So I wound up going to NYU. I went for musical theater. I went to Tisch School of the Arts musical theater program. And that was crazy because I was a pretty good singer and a reasonably okay actor, but a terrible dancer. But they made you dance. You had to do 3 hours of dance 3 days a week, jazz, tap, and ballet. And so I'm dancing up a storm and really bad. I mean, really, really bad. In the lowest level classes, the teachers are like, Christ, because they're all, Broadway choreographers and stuff. And they're like, I guess I hung on by, qualifying or whatever with singing and acting. But then my senior year at NYU, I went to the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. This would have been 1998. And I would have seen the UCB folks do an ASCAT show. And I said, oh, that's what I want to do. So that made me turn a hard left into comedy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you didn't get on to any kind of postgraduate, I'm going to try out for Broadway shows
track. I did. Okay. So I guess I should say that made me want to do comedy, but I was still on this musical track. So I did do a couple musicals after college. Before I graduated, I got the role of Sir Lancelot in a national tour of Camelot. And so wow. I did that. And that was just amazing. I mean, played, I think, like 47 or 48 states. And that was so great. And then I did The Sound of Music at the Westchester Broadway Theater. Not on Broadway, but it's in New York State. And then I moved to LA after that in 2001.
Do you think you would have been happy doing musicals? Like if you'd been able to make a living at that? Or do you think that, like, if, you know, if you had, you know, you'd felt that urge from a UCB show, but then if you'd mm-hmm. been like, nah, I don't think I can pull that off. Do you think have been okay?
No, I really don't. And it wouldn't necessarily have had to have been comedy, but once I got into making my own stuff, and performing stuff that I'd either, you know, thought up myself or written myself, that's where, you know, performing, entertainment, anything artistic began to become, you know, vastly more both important to me, but then also like healthy feeling, you know. Because I felt that I was, you know, making something or synthesizing something out of, mm-hmm. you know, the things I've seen and read. And so yeah, the getting into a realm where I was making up my own stuff, I think was pretty critical. And, I really wouldn't want to do it any other way.
Yeah. And that was. That was a late onset urge, correct? I mean, when you were thought, okay, I'm just going to be Sir Lancelot and Henry Hill, and you know,
yeah.
And it wasn't until wow,
yeah. I mean, I guess not. That's not too late. I mean, I would have been, you know, 22 years old. So
yeah.
Yes, sure. Some people start younger than that. You know, God knows I didn't make any money at any of it until I was quite a bit older, but that's perfectly fine, you know, and par for the course.
So, I mean, is it scary to you to jump from one to the other? Not like doing touring musicals is exactly a surefire fallback.
Right. I mean, I guess it wasn't like now, of course it would be because I, you know, have a family and pay rent in North London, you know, but
yeah.
Like back then, you know, and also a good thing that happened to me was when I finally pulled the trigger and was like, I'm going to do this for a career, you know, like I'm going to just remove all the safety nets. It was more that they were also being removed from me by the global financial crisis, you know, 2007, 2008, things went so down the toilet and so many people's lives were thrown into turmoil and jobs were destroyed that I think a lot of people realized, oh, even getting a job as a lawyer at the big firm or, you know, going to dental school or whatever, anything that you thought previously was a safe bet was not necessarily a safe bet. So it was a good time to, you know, follow a ridiculous dream, which is what
sure.
I thought it was then. But now I don't think that at all. I mean, now I know that life is a fucking shredder that can't wait to kill you and the people you love. And
yeah.
piss, hot, acidic piss on in your throat that you should absolutely do whatever you want. Because it's a miracle if you even survive, let alone have fun. So
yeah.
I don't think it's ridiculous at all to go into the arts or to go into hot air balloon design, whatever insane thing
yeah.
you want to do. it's no more insane than wanting to be a teller at a bank. It's all so uncertain.
For 25 years, Mike's has been making lemonade the hard way. Mike's Hard Lemonade. Hard days deserve a hard lemonade. Mike's is hard. So is prison. Don't drive drunk. Premium all beverage with flavors. All registered trademarks used under license by Mike's Hard Lemonade Company, Chicago, Illinois.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
You've been very frank about your addiction issues. I mean, you know, it's been a big part of your stand-up and a big part of your story. And I'm wondering how that's factoring into this point in your life. Into that point of your life, you know.
Oh, back then. Yeah. So at that point, I'm drinking a lot. And it's creating more and more problems. So, you know, I would say alcohol for me, started to create problems, you know, in my early teens, and then I got sober at 25. So as I'm finishing college and starting to work and then moving to LA, yeah, at that point, my drinking is getting worse. The consequences are getting worse. And it is affecting my ability to, you know, hold on to relationships, be a good friend, capitalize on opportunities that come my way and stuff like that. So I'm afraid of alcohol at that point, quite afraid of it, and want to drink it more than I want to do anything. At the same time. So that was a tough period for that. And then at age 25, I was in a car accident, which was my fault. And after that I got sober because I thought, you know, I didn't care if I died, which is pathetic, but I didn't want to kill anybody else or hurt anybody else. And so when I learned that my drinking unchecked would for sure kill someone, hopefully it would be me, but it really might not be when you're driving drunk. And that made me want to quit. And I haven't drank since then, and that's been 18 years. Alcohol definitely created a detour for me. Which also, you know, is very sort of important and informative because at 25, I get drunk. I'm in a blackout. I go to sleep for the night. I wake up, you know, in quotes, wake up with no memory of this during a blackout and go for a drive into a building, wind up in jail with broken limbs. And at that point, I need to have surgeries and stuff. And I had health insurance at that point, but this was pre-Obamacare because this was during the presidency of George W. Bush. So it's before Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. So your health insurance company could just drop you. And they did when I was started to generate bills that were big. But yet I still needed more care. So I had to find a way to get health insurance. So I actually had a big detour from like 2002 to 2007. I worked at various internet advertising companies and had a bunch of different jobs just so that I could get on a group plan from an employer. And so for a few years, you know, in early sobriety, working these jobs just so I can get health insurance, I'm like, oh, I guess I'm going to be a business guy, you know? And I'm kind of like, you know, it wasn't a nightmare period. Yes, I hated those jobs and sucked at them. But at that time, you know, I'm getting sort of established in sobriety. And I met my wife, you know, with whom I've had four children. So I wouldn't change anything about all that. But it is, you know, that has informed my political beliefs and actions. The fact that I had to, you know, put a dream on a shelf because I needed to get health insurance, which, you know, I don't think people should have to do.
Right.
So that was, you know, that's a sort of important experience that I had.
At this point in your life, you're in recovery, but you're in recovery. You know, you're in two different kinds of recovery. Do you end up like, is part of your process of the recovery from addiction, is it forgiving yourself? And are you able to forgive yourself for this situation? Or are there times when you think, like, if I hadn't been an alcoholic, I wouldn't be in this boat?
Yeah, I don't know about like forgiveness of self. I've never really thought about that. I'm a very like blue collar garden variety alcoholic, and that's also kind of how I approach recovery. Like, I'm like, don't drink, put one foot in front of the other, help another alcoholic. So I don't know, you know. I don't mean
to imply that it's your fault. I'm projecting my own, like, what I think, given the same situation, what I would have done is to think like, way to go, asshole. Now here are doing internet advertising, you know?
Sure. I mean, at the time I was like, I don't know. I was pretty surprised to be alive, to be honest. So I am glad that, you know, the shock of being alive got me, you know, gave me some mileage. But then also, like, mental health wise, I think for me and a lot of people who have drug and alcohol problems, I may have been doing some self-medicating, perhaps, with my drinking, because once I took away the alcohol after I'd been sober for about a year, despite, you know, like going to talk therapy and, you know, not drinking and trying to make healthy lifestyle choices and stuff, I did go into a depression that was very, very bad, with, you know, complete with suicidal ideation and real physical pain. I mean, a lot of physical symptoms from depression, and like a total inability to sleep, you know, diarrhea constantly, having any pee in my bladder at all was like unbearable. If I had like a drop of pee, I was like, I can't have pee in me.
That's a depression characteristic I've never heard before. You found a new one. Yeah,
I mean, so I was a mess. So that's why, like, I am, you know, when I hear people talk about depression and stuff, or if I hear people chastising others for taking medication for depression, I'm like, all right, let's all approach this calmly. You know, depression, when I say depression, I mean like, you know, high grade unipolar depression, where doctors are like, whoa, we got to do something with this guy.
Yeah.
And also, you know, that it's interesting that so with alcohol and drinking, like alcoholism is not that interesting. A lot of people have it, you know, we all know about it. But I think we might not quite be there yet with depression, because even still, you know, like I take antidepressants, and I do still feel like deficient sometimes. You know, I feel like, oh, I wish I didn't have to take these, or, you know, are we about to discover in 5, 10 years or 30 or whatever that in fact you didn't need to take this medication. What you needed to do was, you know, climb this special tree in Austria and say this chant, right, or do these breathing, right, exercises. So,
right, but take, same, beet, but the, take beet extract pills.
Exactly. And so, yeah, but I recognize that I have been sober long enough. I have been around other people in recovery enough. And I've met other people who've suffered from depression. And I know the fact is, you know, and this is something I've heard said many times, but like, if you had a problem, would you begrudge, you know, a diabetic person their insulin, or, you know, somebody with a liver disease, the medicine that they need? You wouldn't. So if it's the brain, it's so funny how the brain will, you know, act to defeat us. And, you know, we know exactly where to find our fears and exploit them, you know, even unconsciously. So it is funny to me and interesting that years later, I'm like, do I need this medicine? And, you know, I think the most people, most doctors, most people, you know, would tend to agree objectively, yes.
I relate 100%, because I've been on antidepressants for decades. Okay. And when I started taking them, this is back in Chicago, ages and ages ago.
Can I just say to anybody tuning in, if you're not familiar with Chicago, it's universally known to be very compassionate to men who have any kind of mental or emotional issues. So I think I know where this is going.
It's a real, yeah. It's known as Pussy Town, because there's so much sensitivity. but I back in Chicago, and I was, it was when I had gotten out of college and I was working in film production, and I, you know, and then trying to start improv, doing improv, and I was just a mess. I was just, and in fact, I went into I saw an ad in the paper with a, you know, are you depressed? The University of Illinois Chicago has a program. And what they did is they gave, it was a program testing elevated levels of a anti-anxiety drug called Buspar, and mm-hmm. seeing if it was helpful for depression. And when I first started it, I felt like, you know, like I had been a deflated balloon and somebody inflated me to my correct weight. And I felt like I was floating, and like, oh, you know, and it's just, it's what normalcy was, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. The normalcy felt like elation. And then their program ended, and they were like, just like, you know, kicked me out on the street without my happy pills. Mm. And I found a shrink that went to a, you know, that had a sliding scale. And it's like you said, I went in, and within about 3 minutes, the doctor's like, you need to be on meds. Like, you know, mm-hmm. like it's like somebody that stinks needs to take a shower. Like, oh, yeah, Jesus. Yeah. And said it was actually fairly, like, almost kind of a malpractice that they allowed me to be in this. Like, I didn't need a, maybe this will work. I needed a, this is going to work.
Yeah.
And right when I started taking them, I had friends that would be like, you know, they'd hear about it and they would say, and these are like not like happy-go-lucky people. These are people with their own issues saying things like, oh, really? Oh, you think a pill's going to fix everything? You know, and
I love that I love that I absolutely know some of these people.
Yeah. Or the, are you going to have to be on it forever? Like, uh-huh. I don't know. It's like you said, yeah. If I was a diabetic, would you be like, well, I guess you're going to lean on that insulin, huh? Like, yes. Yeah. Fucker. But I still have it within me that I think sometimes, like, What would my quality of life be like if I wasn't on these drugs? Right. And maybe I could go off them now and things would be okay, which I know that's not true. Yeah. But I do sometimes, it leaves me wondering what it's like to be normal, you know, what it's like right. to have a fairly normal kind of even keeled disposition, which actually mm-hmm. I should say, I'm going to do a little plug here for Trintellix antidepressant that I started on at the beginning of this year. Mm-hmm. Works better than anything I've ever been on. So ask your doctor about Trintellix. Mm-hmm. COVID aside, this last year, 2020 for me, in terms of it's been a shit year, obviously, mm-hmm. In the world, but I at least am able to cope with it with some sort of modicum of normalcy, of emotional normalcy, and not feel like I'm in a constant kind of have my finger in some sort of emotional dike that it could burst at any minute. This pandemic, being stuck at home, it sucks, but I'm okay. Whereas if it had happened last year, I think I'd be a big fucking mess about it. So, do you think your addiction stuff, I mean, you said it was self-medicating. Do you think it was that right from the beginning? Or do you think it was just such a chemical thing with you that because I've had friends who are now sober who say like when they were in high school and they, that first drink, it was like just accelerator to the floor for them in terms of drinking.
For me, absolutely, it was chemical. I had a sip of alcohol and I thought, this is it. It was like a chemical equation being completed. Here I am. It felt good and correct and just so vastly better to not have alcohol in me. So. Just immediate lightning bolt magic.
Were your parents aware of this, do you think?
They were. I try to keep it secret, so maybe that works, a little bit. They might not have known the whole picture. I don't know. It's like there was a lot of alcoholism on both sides of my family, so they had probably seen, or they rather they had seen other people try to manage problem drinking. And, I don't know what they did. They, triangulated and figured out, where mine fit and tried to game out how bad it could be. They weren't like, you've got a car accident in your future. I would estimate it would happen within 5 to 7 years. Injury level orange, I think
the injuries were pretty crazy. The injuries in that accident were.
Yeah. I mean, they were, well, what was the fun part was that both my arms were in casts. So I was quite, temporarily disabled by the accident. And could only use one arm at a time as they operated on them because they had to put some metal into the right arm, which was very badly broken. And then they had to do a surgery on the left wrist, which was broken. So I looked funny. I think also that was helpful for comedy development as well because I did live, I was sentenced to a month in rehab and then 3.5 months in a sober living halfway house. So I'm in a house that you wouldn't notice if you drove by it in West LA, but it's a big house with a bunch of bedrooms, with a bunch of bunk beds and a bunch of guys who just got out of prison and me. And so we've got like big guys, scary guys, violent guys. And I can't physically defend myself in any way, shape, or form. So I remember, you know, actively trying to like make guys laugh so that they would like me, really trying to ingratiate myself in ways that were like, you know, the right level of like charming, but not pathetic, so that they didn't see me as a target. Like I really tried to like surgically assert myself and be a part of the thing in a way that was like not offensive, but not like I wanted everybody to so extremely like me so that they wouldn't beat the shit out of me or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So that was, I think, helpful and a good thing for somebody like me, because I'm like a gigantic person, you know? So it was very funny, I say that with years distance. At the time, I was terrified, but it was useful to me, I think, as a performer to have to develop skills that I wouldn't have otherwise, you know?
But I absolutely know, but I mean, is there no pity in this place? I mean, you're obviously, you've got both arms fucked up and was it just your arms? Was there anything below there that was?
Yeah, pretty much. Like nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing else was broken. Like I had scars on my legs were cut badly, but once they were sewn up, it didn't matter. Just the arms.
Now, how does one with both arms compromised and living in a halfway house, how does one upkeep one's hygiene?
It's challenging. I had to put like a – so I didn't shower that often. And when I did, I would have to like put a trash bag over whichever arm was in like a post-surgical cast splint.
Yeah. Yeah.
And put a trash bag over it and then like using my teeth and the other hand, like wrap tape around my upper arm and then shower with the one hand, that wasn't taped up in a cast. And so, yeah, it was really hard. It was hard to wipe my butt. I mean, it totally sucked.
Did you have to have people wipe your butt for you at some point?
No, you know, and I remember being grateful that was the case. That I would never want anybody to wipe my butt. But a couple of years later, the way I met my wife was volunteering at a camp for kids and adults with disabilities. And so I wiped a lot of adults' butts soon after my arms were healed. And
yeah,
it's after you wipe a couple butts, it's no big deal. So now I would totally let somebody wipe my ass. And I mean, no shame at all.
Yeah, that sounds to me like a post-COVID fan sweepstakes, you know?
Oh, definitely.
After the show, I mean, come on backstage and wipe Rob.
Cameo or, definitely. part of a meet and greet.
Yeah. Three lucky fans get to get one wipe each.
Yep. I'm meeting a lot of prunes.
Yeah.
Whatever. To make a... anyway, you get the picture.
Yeah, I sure do. So
you came up with it.
I did. I forced it on you. At this point, am I wrong in thinking that Twitter kind of, you were sort of like, were you still working a day job when your sort of Twitter fame started and notoriety started to happen?
Yeah. So, it was 2009 that I joined Twitter, and at this point, I'm doing stand-up, like all over LA. I'll fly. I'm getting paid to do stand-up in the sense that, like, I get paid, say, $600 to do a few shows in Minneapolis, but it costs me $601 to get there and get a hotel room. So it's that type of stuff. But at the same time, I'm submitting joke packets to every late night show, Conan, Kimmel, Chelsea Handler, and others, and trying to get hired that way. So I'm writing short jokes all the time when Twitter showed up. So I think that helped me because, you know, comedians in 2009 were like, hey, can we, wait a minute, can we be funny on this? You know? And so jokes were one of the first things that were, that made Twitter, you know, worth it. And so that helped me use Twitter. And then the follower number would grow. And then that made it easier to sell tickets in Cleveland and wherever. And so it was a, it was very, very helpful, Twitter to, for all aspects of disseminating, my disease.
Well, now your disease is, a pretty hilarious disease, but it is, I mean, you know, I think you made a splash by just kind of, I don't even know thematically how you would, you know, it's, it's kind of playing sort of like this persona, this the grossest person in the world, sort of, I think, at times is what you assume. And was this, I mean, your wife and her karate teacher and you know, and also like a very particular libido that's focused on, you know, body hair and sweat and things like that, you know? Is this, when you start doing that, are you worried like, oh, this is not going to help my career?
A little bit sometimes, but I kind of thought like, this is, like when Twitter started and, you know, people start like among the first people would follow in 2009 would be like CNN, you know, people would be like, oh, you know, you can like curate like a feed of things you find interesting, you know, so you could follow your favorite football team and whatnot. And I thought like, you know what, there's enough crap in the world and apps and doodads. I was like, if... And it bugged the hell out of me to see like businesses trying to use it. And so I was just like, you know what, people, if you have had the audacity to download this foolish app and try to be informed by it, then I want you, when you're scrolling through your feed of where the taco truck, you know, what, you know, tornado is sweeping through your state, I also want you to have to see something bizarre and insane and maybe upsetting. And so myself and others at that time, you know, recognized like it was good for developing like the quick hit, incredibly absurd or silly thing when people weren't expecting it necessarily. You know, they're going through because they want to see how the Titans did. And then they're going to have to hear about, you know, me watching a woman change out of her wetsuit through a hole in a barn. You know what I mean?
Why is she in her wetsuit in the barn? That's what I want to know.
I can't get into that. Yeah, that's for Twitter Plus. I mean, but, you know, like, so I just thought this is so stupid. And I always hate new technologies when they come out and get angry at them. So I was like, how dare Twitter exist and how dare people use it? So I just wanted to just put stuff out there that made people be like, ugh, you know, or laugh, you know, but just any, make them feel anything, you know?
Yeah. I feel like you were one of the people that sort of like showed me what it could be, you know, like getting on there and, you know, you just seeing you retweet it. Cause I got on there in the crassest, just most, just asshole show busy way, which was that. Uh-huh. And I think it would have been 2010. Yeah. And I think that the TBS, or no, it might've even been when we were on the Tonight Show. I don't even know if it was when we started the Tonight Show or whether it was the TBS show or whether it's the weird in between time, but I was invited to play in the baseball All-Star weekend was in Anaheim.
Oh my God.
And I was invited to play in the, and I did it twice. Mm-hmm. There's a, old timers and celebrity softball game. That's like part of the part of the shenanigans that happened. And so I was invited to go down there, and the production, one of the production managers from Conan said to me, they got in touch with us and said, they said like Twitter got in touch with us and said, they knew that I was doing this, and Twitter asked if I would join Twitter and tweet about it, that it, there's a possibility I might get a new iPhone and whatever that, you know, iPhone 2 or whatever was that happened to be at that time. And I was just like, all right, fine. And I signed on and whatever phone I, you know, my Palm Pilot or whatever the fuck I was using at that time, and signed up for Twitter just to see if I could get a new cell phone. And I could, because at the time I had like, there was Facebook and I was kind of on Facebook, but what I didn't like about Facebook was just what I find out now is the ability to write such long texts and your accessibility people, and that you're sort of, I felt like I was always trapped in a conversation sort of. And then once I got into Twitter, I was like, oh my God, this is like so suited to people with minute attention spans, which is me.
And I
also really loved the challenge of writing a tweet, like writing a good tweet and seeing that it's its own form. And if you, and I loved, like, if I can get three jokes into one joke into less than 140 characters, it's an incredibly satisfying, it's like a haiku or something. It's a very formulaic thing. And it's like, if you can sort of like, you know, it's like crack of jokes, you know, just distilled down to its purest, strongest, fast hit and run thing. And also, frankly, a lot of my friends that in my life now, I know you because of Twitter. I mean, we're talking now because, there was Twitter, and then I think you invited me to do some stuff. I think you were doing a pilot that maybe was the first time
That was massive. I that would be fun if I could ever get that shown somewhere. But yeah, I made a Comedy Central pilot, and you were my guest on it, and we had big fun, and you were so gracious.
Yeah.
It was so wonderful of you to do that. Really.
Well, I was happy. I mean, I don't, the graciousness, it's like, you know, one of the reasons that I even do this is to be around funny people. Like, I don't even, you know, I like making a living, and you know, and at a certain point, you know, there was time that went by where I was kind of charged up and thinking like, I'm going to take the world by storm. But always running through, and especially now, the most important thing is to have fun and be around funny people. And life is so short. So I think, you know, people bitch about it, and it can be, it can feel like a cesspool at times, but you know, Twitter's definitely improved my life. You know, I mean, it's given me lots of fun and lots of good times.
Yeah.
And also, you know, and also at times made me feel like, you know, spending so much time arguing with gun nuts in my life. And then realizing like, there are still guns. It's not working.
Right.
Whatever I'm doing,
I mean, it's
taking more from me.
Getting upset at anything, and I do mean anything that takes place on Twitter, is the same thing as seeing a big shit on the ground and going over and be like, oh my God, look at that shit. And then like picking it up and rubbing it on your shirt and in your hair. And you're like, oh, I hate this shit. Like, just turn it off, man. Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually a tweet, but I mean, it's like, the simile that I found is that it's like trying to drown a vampire in your own blood. Like, you just end up
attempting to
kill this beast. You're just subtracting from yourself. You're just
totally.
you're Yeah, the energy that you are giving that's taking away from you, they're living for it. They're feeding on it. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But then there are times it's nice to tell someone to fuck off. That's always nice. Sure. That's not bad. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Online so or off. I met is when you like say that was that talk show, it was a Comedy Central, right?
It was, yeah.
Was that your first kind of television thing of your own project?
Yeah,
of
my own. Yeah, certainly. And that was a lot of fun. They didn't pick it up. And I think I was upset for like 20 minutes. And then I just booked a stand-up tour and did shows all over the country, which was tremendous fun. And wrote a book. But no, I mean, that was very educational, making that pilot, and very fun.
And is at that point, I mean, are you kind of just kind of, what do you think you're doing with your career at that point? Like, what are you going to be a stand-up? Are you going to, you know, you write a book. So it's, are you going to be a book writer? Are you going to be a talk show host? Because I think that that was kind of what that show was.
Oh, sure.
Or are you just kind of trying it all and seeing what happens?
I mean, I wanted to be fun. you know, stand up is great to have at the core of it, which is so weird. It feels so weird to say that having not done stand up now in several months, which I really hate. You know, yeah, for stand up to be like at the heart of it is a maybe. I mean, I guess if you could describe my career in one word, I hope comedian at this point would be sort of the catch-all.
I would say.
Yeah. So, but yeah, anytime, as long as people are laughing, you know, I mean, I love to write stuff, by myself, and I love to do stand up by myself, but I also love to collaborate. Like, there's nothing more rewarding than writing a script and then giving it to a director who is not me. And then, you know, involving, you know, loads of other people to help make it come to fruition. So, and that's a good thing. That's a wonderful thing about this career, is that you can do stuff like in isolation and then, you know, foist it on the world at a later date. Or you can work together with others, which is really nice because you can kind of feed the introvert and the extrovert. And it's a pretty, I'm quite grateful to be able to work in it in a few different capacities.
Yeah. I mean, aside from stand-up is, I mean, you need managers to help you and, you know, it's good to have a community, but it is a fairly solitary pursuit. And I think it's like there are lots of other pursuits in show business where I don't think people realize how collaborative it is. Like every really funny actor that you've seen has probably had somebody helping him shape ideas. And, you know, even when they get a movie, they, you know, has it, you know, which is the sort of secret wonderful part, I think, of the more collaborative nature of doing this kind of stuff. And speaking of which, when you and was Catastrophe something that you and Sharon Horgan worked on immediately together? Did you conceive of it together, or?
Yeah, we did. I got a script deal with the BBC, and they said, write a script about whatever. And so then I said to Sharon, I said, hey, do you want to write something together? And we had the vague idea that it would be about a married couple and the challenges that life threw at them. And so, yeah, we'd known each other for a couple years, 2-3 years before we decided to work on that together. But there
I just wanted to say, like, how does that UK connection begin? Like, you know, how do you go from being an LA comic that's touring here to even having a contract with the BBC?
Okay. The way that that worked is I didn't realize it at the time when I signed with my manager, a long time ago. But in fact, my management company, which was not that big at the time in the United States, was the American satellite of a big British management company. So when I expressed interest in going to the UK, they were like, it was so easy to do. So I came over and started just doing stand up here. And then because Twitter allowed you to become known in a foreign country without even having ever been there, you know, or worked there, that made it easier to sell tickets when I came over here. So I was doing stand up over here, and that's when the BBC was like, "Hey, do you want to write a script for us?" And I said, "Yes, on the condition that you let me do it with my very funny friend Sharon." So we did that, and that's what became Catastrophe. So we were very, very lucky to have that, you know, work out on our first endeavor together.
Your kids were quite small then, weren't they?
Yeah, when I moved to the UK, the older two were 3 and 1.
Was that a daunting prospect? Did that ever make you feel like, you know, like, is this the right thing?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it was brutal for my wife. I mean, it was really like damaging to her and to our relationship, because we lived in, you know, we had like a big backyard in sunny Santa Monica, and she had a job that she loved. And so we moved over here with her pregnant with our third. She doesn't know anybody, loses her job, not loses her job, but, you know, gives it up. Thinking it's going to be temporary, and then it turns out not to be. So it was very, very difficult. So my domestic situation in moving to the UK was real upheaval. The brunt of it borne by my wife. And I had to like really change my work habits, because when I first came over here, you know, this is my first show. I'm like, I have to do everything. I can't delegate anything, which is, you know, can be a fatal error for people, certainly for their real life relationships, you know, and their sanity and all that. And so it was very tumultuous and difficult moving over here. And then at a certain point, my wife was like, we are going to make some changes. And when I say we, I mean you, and they're going to be dramatic. She helped me understand how serious the issues were. And so I did. And so for like this third and fourth season of Catastrophe, I learned how to delegate, you know, worked smarter rather than harder. And so that was very educational for me, and it really helped me adjust the work-life balance in a way that was more sustainable, because I definitely fucked it up in the beginning, and am so happy that, you know, we were able to course correct.
Yeah. When were you just like spending too much time at work, kind of? Was that sort of the basic, or?
Yeah. And not acknowledging that, you know, I had moved my dynamic, fun, funny, popular wife with friends and a job into a basement flat in a country where she knew no one. And I was like, good luck. And she's pregnant with another one of my kids. And responsible for a 3 and 1 year old. And, you know, the weather's a little different here in Santa Monica. And, it's just, it was just vicious, for her. And so now it's vastly, you know, a world of difference, but,
Yeah, that was, I had that same learning process, you know, 20 years ago in my marriage, from going from the Conan show to coming out here with a little baby. And also, I didn't know how to use Los Angeles. So we moved to a house in the Palisades, which was whereas all our what friends we did have here were all on the east side in Los Feliz and Silver Lake and downtown. And, you know, and we'd been here about four or five. And also, too, I was shooting a single camera show, which is 16 hour days. And so there would be three and four days would go by when I wouldn't see my son awake, because I'd leave before he'd wake up and I'd come home when he was still asleep. And, you know, and I thought I was being sensitive, but I needed to be, it was the same thing. I needed to be made aware. And, she didn't say it like this, but it's like, I did realize like about 3 or 4 months in, like, oh, I kind of ruined my wife's life. You know, like this is bad. And, and I also think too, and this is just whatever partner, and it's usually, in a heterosexual couple, it's usually the wife that's mostly in charge of the childcare, and and so the other person is going out and living this life and coming home tired from work, and this other person has just been here with this, you know, crying ball of flesh all day.
Yeah,
and I, you know, there was times I'd come home, I didn't have anything left, and it was just. It was really tough and really unfair, and it's hard to navigate that. And and good for you guys for, you know, figuring it out.
Well, I'll be honest. I credit my wife tremendously. I don't take a lot of credit. I mean, it's like a little, but primary credit would go to the fact that our son got so sick and we had to really make sure that our family was the highest priority for every member of it so that we could survive it in the best way possible, you know? So, you know, it was one of those things where, I mean, obviously I would, you know, lop my arm off happily and gleefully to bring back our son, Henry, but that's not possible. And, in his illness and in his death, you know, my wife and myself and our older boys, a lot of beautiful stuff happened, you know, as we navigated all that, and as difficult as it was, and it remains very difficult. There was a lot of, I don't know, just grace and warmth and kindness and stuff that just helped us all through it all. And it certainly helped guide me in my decision-making process in being kinder and more present. I mean, that was the biggest factor, I think, for all of us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have always exhibited poise, you know, I mean, even, you know, in hearing, honestly, I mean that. I mean, you know, in like the way that you recovered from your addiction issues and from the accident and, you know, making lemonade out of lemons so many times, it's enviable and it's admirable and I mean, what you went through with your son, you know, a lot of times I was thinking about, you know, before talking to you here, I was thinking, you know, when something so gutting happens, you know, people often say like, you know, like I can't even imagine. And I was thinking like, I can't imagine. Mm-hmm. I'm a father and I can't imagine the ability to move on from something that can just seem so absolutely apocalyptic in a personal sense. It's been it's been valuable to watch, not just me, I think for lots of people. So,
well, thanks.
You're welcome. Well, now what? Now what? Are, you're still over there. You're what are you working on these days? What and sort of just in a greater sort of you know, philosophical sense. What next?
Short answer, I don't know. I have no idea. To expand upon that.
All right. Well, nice talking to you.
To expand upon that. I just submitted a script to a network, that I wrote over here. And we'll see what they think of it, if they'd like to, make a series out of it. And that was a lot of fun to write. It's the first thing that I've, you know, put a lot of work and care into, since Henry's death. And I'm glad I waited a couple of years, because I think it can be, you know, I wanted to not write about it directly, his death, but I knew it needed to, you know, course through me and become a part of me. And, you know, I had to sort of grapple with the new person that I was, because I mean, I really feel like a different person, having, you know, with the things that change in you after having a child die. And so this, so I've written something that has a lot of jokes per page, but is quite dark. Hopefully, I hope we get to make that. I won't say anything else about it now because, you know, it's still in the oven.
And also I'm a terrible thief. I will steal it. If you give me even an ounce of an idea of what it's about,
I'll be seeing it on Stars before Christmas.
I'm zooming with Cinemax in 10 minutes from now.
That's good. Now,
can you stay in the UK as long as you'd like? I mean, is there a certain point
we have a finite visa. We have a very good long visa, but it's finite. They'll want to renew it. We're not citizens, but we do, we are here on a visa where you don't have to like leave every 6 months and get fingerprinted in New York and then fly back. I guess we'll live here, for the foreseeable. I love being an employee. I love acting in other people's, movies. So have a few movies that'll come out in the coming months, that are other people's, creations and that were really fun to work on. And I hope we can get back to stand up soon. The other day somebody's like, how come you're not doing stand up? And I was like, well, I'm going to let the 22-year-olds figure out how stand up works I don't have enough time. I don't have time. And I'm also taking advantage of this time to just be with my kids. So once it gets figured out and we figured out the sort of plasticine, you know, costume that we wear and we're suspended from a helicopter or whatever, once that's figured out, I will absolutely be back doing stand up. Otherwise, you know, figuring out how to be a good dad and husband, how to engage politically, you know, I mean, we don't have to talk about this too much, but you know, it is gratifying that people are now learning, myself included, you know, how important the daily actions that we take are, and the magnificence and the beauty and the glory of the Black Lives Matter protesters around the US and the world. You know, I think people are now getting hip to the fact that with income inequality where it is at this point, and it's very bad, and where things are headed with the environment, and again, very bad, that voting every 4 years or every 2 years, if you're a real star, is just not enough. So that's great. So I want to try to help figure out how to get more involved, you know, with the day-to-day, you know, local, much smaller elections, you know, city councils, mayors, DAs, and then unions, and work with them just so people can be more engaged. Because, you know, look, hey, it'd be great if we could just go on autopilot and not have to really worry about it. But, you know, you know, my political consciousness switched on during really what is historically a blip, when, you know, things were seemed to be coasting and seemed to be okay for, you know, a small percentage of people, but now it's even growing smaller. So, you know, I just am so grateful for everybody who's in the streets and doing the real work. And just want to make sure to do that and help people do that the best that I can.
Yeah. You all have a very positive political engagement, which I think is rare. I mean, often it's got, I mean, like I said, I'm somewhat political on in public, and often, like, I let sort of anger and self-righteousness bleed into it too much. And I think you do a great job of kind of remaining positive and persuasive. I mean, because I think persuasion is absent from a lot of discussion, and that is the bottom line, is if you have a firm belief that this is the way that things will be better, calling someone an asshole for thinking different is probably not the best.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's so enticing. Yeah. I mean, I have to you know, put the brakes on myself too, to stop myself from doing that, because you want to do it. I mean, it's good fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a solid dopamine hit, calling somebody an asshole.
Yep.
But at the same time, I think it's more for me, I've been more successful when it's been, you know, attraction rather than promotion, and telling about my experiences with, you know, socialized medicine over here, national healthcare. It just seems to be far more effective than saying, this is how it should be, and if you don't think so, you're an idiot, you know? I would rather demonstrate that it's so good to have this stuff that you can bypass, that you can kind of bypass the name calling, where you're like, oh, hey, that looks interesting, you know? And
Well, it's, now, you use the phrase figure out this and that. I wonder, when you say figure out, if you could distill, like, what you've figured out into kind of like a short, punchy statement that a podcast asshole like me will love to put a button on this thing.
Okay,
what do you think you've figured out?
So for me, a big example of how to persevere in this world is the cockroach. I really try to emulate the cockroach, because, you know, so many incredibly good things have happened to me and for me that are really beyond belief. Then also, I have had some really terrible things happen to me that have been enormously difficult and that I've barely been able to survive. Those things are... I try to, like, I know it sounds crazy and like Chekhovian and all that, but like, I really try to endure, you know, and I try not to hate the bad things that have happened to me. And this is like a very messy and tortured metaphor, but it is the central one for my life. At the end of Back to the Future, Doc Brown shows up, and instead of having to get struck by lightning, he now, attached to the flux capacitor, has the thing that says Mr. Fusion on it. Mm-hmm. And you'd no longer need to be struck by lightning because of what he's learned in the future. You can just put anything in and it will feel banana peel, hat, like anything will fuel it. So for me, I try to think that I, you know, like, have a Mr. Fusion inlet in my head or my heart or both. And so I try to take the good and the bad and understand that they can fuel me forward. And that has really served me well, the sort of Mr. Fusion belief. and attitude, because things are going to get thrown at you that are incredibly painful and incredibly difficult to absorb and make peace with. And it's going to happen. It is going to happen. So if it's going to happen, then I try not to hate it. I try to, you know, weave it into my life and my experience. Like with Henry's death, sometimes I'll be crying and I'll be sad. And I'll tell myself, and this might sound crazy, I'll tell myself, it's okay. You'll be sad forever. And then I kind of feel better because I'm like, oh, I don't have to heal in this moment. I don't have to come up with answers. I get to carry his memory in my heart and forever. I get to feel however I want, whenever I want. And if that's, you know, sadness, well, that would make sense, you know, and it's okay. Those are a couple things that I know. I mean, I know that's messy, but I do believe all that quite deeply.
It's quite beautiful. I mean, I don't think of Back to the Future as beautiful, it's fun. But no, that's a beautiful way to think of it. And it occurs to me as you're saying it, it's a kind of victory. It's kind of the ability to, it really kind of like if bad things are bad, it's a way to conquer bad. It's a way, you know, it's a way to sort of, it's a beautiful thing. I shouldn't even say anything after it because it was, you put it so well. So, and thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I know it's dinner time over there and I miss you and I hope to see you soon.
I miss you too, pal.
Yeah.
And thank you. All right. This was really fun.
I'm glad. And and good luck on the new script. Anything else? Is there anything you want to plug? Is there any,
I don't think so. You know, I mean, if people haven't seen, I had a stand-up special come out earlier this year on Amazon Prime. So you can watch that.
Very funny. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. No grooming products. No line of housewares?
There's a shampoo that smells like Lestoil over here that I really like a lot. It's called Faith in Nature Tea Tree Oil, and it smells like the Lestoil I would use to clean my kitchen floor as a child. And so it brings me back to that. I don't want to smell like that, but I do because I love to smell it in the shower every day. So
Get
some Faith in Nature Tea Tree Oil shampoo. It smells fucking exactly like Lestoil floor cleaner.
All right, Rob. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
and thank all of you out there for listening. And we will see you next time on the Three Questions. I've got a big, big love
for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Beckton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.